Social justice is complex and challenging. In a country of peace, order, and good government, there are many concerns about how we get along globally and follow the golden rule. We are feeling a little edgy right now. Compassionate justice groups, speakers, have addressed a very wide range of issues, as Dan said, from the criminal justice system to income inequality. Today, our focus is not on a particular social justice issue. We are looking at the how. What tools are useful in resolving justice concerns? I'm very pleased to introduce Fiona Crean, a woman who has outstanding experience in striving for justice. Fiona has dealt with a huge spectrum of issues in her career. Her expertise is resolution, and particularly the use of an ombudsman in the resolution process. Her work was recognized in 2015 with the YWCA Women of Distinction Award, which noted that as Toronto ombudsman, she was a force in this city, breaking down barriers, opening doors, and building an equitable city for all of us. In 2016, Fiona was awarded Ontario's highest honor for public service, the Lieutenant Governor's Medal of Distinction in Public Administration. The award noted that she has broken new ground throughout her career in her quest for equity and fairness. She's walked many, many paths, just a few: the Ontario Human Rights Commission, workplace systemic racism and sexism in the prison system, good governance with First Nations and Inuit communities in Canada, maladministration and corruption internationally, Chief Operating Officer at the Office of Ontario Ombudsman, and the founding Ombudsman, York University, the City of Toronto, and Hydro One. And here, Fiona is embarking on a new path in the future. This week past, it was announced that she is departing Hydro One in March to accept the role of Chief Operating Officer of Inspire, a national charity under the leadership of Roberta Jameson that invests in and advocates equitable, accessible, and culturally relevant education for Indigenous youth. Fiona has titled her talk today, Seeking Equity and Fairness in New Ways. Given disturbing populism in our political and social culture, we appreciate some food for critical thinking and discussion following her talk about new ways to maintain social justice. Fiona Crean.
Thank you, Anne. Is this on? I just want to make a comment to add to Dan's, which is I'm not here to answer Hydro One bill problems. It's a pleasure to be here speaking with a group of people who are clearly concerned and involved as a society and where it is that we're all going. It definitely is the best of times and the worst of times, I would say. The benefits of globalization have been showered upon most of us here, but at the same time, we've seen an increasing inequality in how these benefits are distributed across society. Over many years now, the real incomes of most people have failed to grow, And the middle class has been squeezed. In fact, the middle class has in turn defended its own interests and often shown a growing disrespect and resentment towards those on social assistance and others struggling at the bottom of the social ladder. The populist movement under former Mayor Rob Ford, the situation south of the border, Brexit in the UK, the rise of the Front National in France, and the political movements in Austria and the Netherlands are all markers of our failed policy consensus. As a result, ordinary citizens have lost trust in our public institutions. They believe those institutions benefit somebody else, not them. In an American survey by the Pew Research Center a year before the recent election in the US, the results showed that only 19% of the respondents said they could trust government always or most of the time. And 74% said that most elected officials put their own interests ahead of the country. A similar Canadian survey in 2014 found that, and I will quote, many participants spontaneously contrasted what they viewed as a waste of taxpayer dollars by rich politicians to their more difficult personal situation. We're living in a tumultuous time of public distrust and discord, where institutions and the precedents we grew up with are increasingly felt to be irrelevant to people's lives. And frankly, having watched the institution of Toronto's City Council up close, I'm hard-pressed to deny that we have earned that we haven't earned that distrust. How do we turn that around? Well, to start with, I think that people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have got it right. We need to address economic inequality. That's going to be hard because people like you and me will have to give up something. That could be why it's been easier for progressive middle-class folks to address cultural and identity politics, because it doesn't cost them anything. But I think we also need to find new ways to solve problems and generate consensus. And we need to find new ways to hold our politicians and our public institutions, as well as our private businesses, to account. That may be the most important question of the day. How do we hold those in power accountable? Well, the entities that have done a lot to hold those in power accountable are the Ombudsman and Ombudsman-like institutions across Canada. This afternoon, I'd like to spend some time talking about how an Ombudsman can resolve conflict and bring about greater fairness and systemic change. That's what I did as the Ombudsman for the City of Toronto. When I was there, we saw many Toronto residents who had no voice, who were vulnerable, many who were marginalized, from people trying to get their Ontario Works money on a Friday afternoon for their insulin to residents who couldn't find shelter beds. Those individuals often fell through the cracks of the system, unresponsive or deaf to their whispers for help. Here's another example. A woman living with advanced Alzheimer's in her home with 24/7 care had a tree in her garden cut down and was charged $5,000 for the removal of the wood. We thought this would be a fairly simple case. The city inspector contended that he didn't recognize her medical condition. We proposed individual remedies and fixed things for the person. But here's what was much more important. We found that the city had no means of dealing with residents who have diminished capacity. So we pursued a systemic fix that would prevent others in the future from having to go through this kind of experience. The city actually created a framework for the civic service so that they could respond appropriately to residents with diminished capacity across all departments and agencies. At the same time, more mundane but important, we found that local government did not respond properly to what I call the red tape issues, negatively impacting small businesses. Here's a story. A cornice on a building that a small business owner was renovating was in danger of falling down and hurting a passing member of the public. So the fellow ran off to get the proper equipment to replace the cornice. And then an inspector from another department came along and said, "Ah, no, you have to have a permit to do that. In the meantime, this dangerous cornice is hanging." Toronto Hydro, who had a vested interest in their wires, removed the offending cornice overnight. Crazy rules. Rules that made no sense. Here's another one. Until recently, small business owners, regardless of their location in the city, had to go in person to the East York Civic Center to renew their business permits. Frustrating, raising the question about whether government is in fact sufficiently nimble or responsive enough to citizens. I'm happy to tell you, you can now do it online. These are examples of conflicts that an ombudsman is well positioned to resolve. They're problems that would not easily be resolved or even addressed by the courts. And frankly, most people have neither the wherewithal or the patience for the long court battles that end in someone being right and someone being wrong. The ombudsman concept is an elegant alternative to the courts. It's non-adversarial, and it's a process by which individuals can find quick, flexible, and affordable resolutions. Ombudsman resolutions don't apportion blame, but rather seek remedial fixes that can both educate and improve the situation for all the parties involved. It's also an avenue for systemic change in law, in process, in policy, in regulation that are almost never addressed in the courts. So, surprise, surprise, I believe that a well-functioning ombudsman office is an important avenue for restoring public trust in our institutions. Not only are ombudsmen an accessible way for people to get their problems solved, but they're also fundamentally a statement by the institution, by the government, by the business, that it isn't perfect, that mistakes happen, and that it needs to hold itself accountable for those mistakes. I'm talking about problems that have a big impact on individual people and determine whether that person can feel the institution or government has treated them fairly at the end of the day. I tell you, there is no such thing as a federal ombudsman of general jurisdiction. Anybody with a pension problem in the audience, there's nowhere to go except for the department that issues the pension. So what about this word fairness? The idea of fairness that I'm talking about is equity, not the conventional sense of equality. Equitable fairness is about making sure that people are treated fairly, not necessarily identically. It starts out with the principle that we're not all the same. This means people and groups must be treated differently so that they have an access to an equitable result. To some, there appears to be a conflict between fairness that is defined by the conventional sense of equality and the inclusive model of equity. It can be a deeply held belief that treating people fairly must rely on treating everybody the same and allow the results to simply emerge. Treating everyone the same absolves us of any further responsibility. Treating people differently is thought to be discriminatory or unfair. In fact, treating people differently to provide access to the same result is key to delivering fairness. To intend to be fair is important, but it's the result that matters. Being inclusive is critical if we're going to remove barriers to service and deliver results that are fair to everyone. This broader definition of fairness explicitly takes into account a person's social location. What do I mean by that? It takes into account education, literacy, disability, age, geographic origin, location, sexual orientation, gender, and so the list goes on. Should a member of the public show any of these disadvantages, we make efforts as ombudsman to redress any imbalance that that disadvantage has created. Intervening in the interests of fairness, of fair treatment, sounds simple. It's not. Each one of us knows what we mean when we say we have a right to be treated fairly. But I suspect of the 60, 70 people in this room, there'll be 60 or 70 different definitions of fairness. Everyone has their own view of fairness, and it can be based on a deeply held conviction or an intuitive understanding of what is unfair. Who hasn't, at some time or another, heard the expression, "but that's not fair"? Fairness is culturally specific. It's shaped by a person's life experience, values, ethics, expectations, and a host of other environmental factors. So why is the mantra of fairness so important? Simply put, it's about getting to better outcomes. The fact is, there are three roads to fixing problems when things go wrong: litigate, negotiate, or design a solution. And it's the last where ombudsman can make the greatest contribution. Let me give you another example. In 2013, seniors living in Toronto community public housing were being evicted or threatened for eviction for non-payment of arrears as little as $300. I'll repeat that, $300. This population, by definition, is poor, frequently marginalized, often with dementia and various forms of mental ill health. The housing authority, of course, has an obligation to collect its rent, but its methods were bureaucratic, rule-bound, without regard for who their tenants were. 2013, this was going on. I'm happy to tell you that we fashioned a lot of changes at a systemic level in the system and in the processes, including humanizing the service and providing people with skills development and changes in reporting relationships. The problem was that tenants were fundamentally viewed as other. If we're to solve problems and create a more inclusive society, we need to understand the other. We need to place ourselves in other people's shoes. Not only of the newly arrived Muslim immigrant, but also of the white male struggling to make ends meet outside the downtown core of Toronto. And in order to be open to diversity, we need to fundamentally change our way of governing. No doubt we've made huge strides in bilingualism and multiculturalism, but they've also become our fault lines. And we have totally failed to hold our government and institutions accountable in Canada to its obligations in addressing Indigenous issues. Over 14 years ago, then UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said this about the contribution of Indigenous peoples to civilization. He said, and I quote, "Indigenous peoples must be full partners in efforts to protect their children, just as they must participate in all decisions that affect their communities. They must play their full part. Here we are in February 2017, and we continue to grapple with that same challenge. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has concluded its work. How many people know anything about its 94 action steps? And I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. Why don't we know what they are? The inquiry into murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls has just begun. I actually believe that this country is at a crucial crossroads in getting it right and addressing its dark past. Now, today, is the opportunity to address the wrongs and balance relationships between Indigenous people across the country and the rest of Canada. As Ojibwe broadcaster Jesse Wente recently said, and I'm going to quote from him quite extensively, "We're in an interesting moment. The nation will be celebrating its 150th birthday. And birthdays always bring a moment for reflection and self-examination. Colonialism has robbed me and many of our land, of our culture, of our language, but it has also robbed you of those things. How much richer would your understanding of Canada be if you knew our stories? How much richer would this year's celebration be if we already knew each other? Think of all that knowledge that has been lost, not just to me, but to you. Imagine if you knew our stories already. You might know us. And if Canada truly knew us, it would be harder to hate and easier to love. Maybe we would be equals instead of mascots for your sports teams and your summer camps. Maybe it would be harder to let our communities go without clean drinking water. Maybe it would be harder to break the treaties, the true foundational documents of Canada. Maybe it would be harder to let our children go with less than all other children. It would be harder to steal our children. Maybe if Canada knew our stories, it wouldn't stand by and watch our children take their own lives. Canadians should be angry that this was taken from them as well. It's kept you strangers on the land you now call home." Jesse's call spoke strongly to me, and the opportunity to participate in rebalancing our relationship with Canada's Indigenous people is the reason that I'm leaving Hydro One to become its chief operating officer. For years, the Ombudsman... Is that me? For years, the Ombudsman profession has lobbied for a federal Ombudsman of Indigenous issues. I say it's high time for the federal government to create such an institution. The importance of having Ombudsman institutions cannot be overemphasized during these conflicted times. It is, I think, the Ombudsman who can hold large and powerful institutions to account in unique ways. Look at the example of the public appointments process at the City of Toronto. Government depends on thousands of volunteers to sit on boards and committees, police services boards, sports arenas, libraries, and so on. There was a robust public service process in place that wasn't working in 2012. When the Ombudsman Office investigated, we found that the former mayor had interfered in the selection process. We found, in fact, that there was a secret list of preferred candidates and a total disregard of the rules that were in place. What court or arbitral process would have exposed such a practice, put in place the necessary improvements? The answer is none. In Canada, we've had a good experience with problem solving, with mediation. with finding the middle ground. Maybe it comes from the words, the famous words in our Constitution, peace, order, and good government. But we can't rest on our laurels. We have much work to do. To start with, I believe that every Canadian should see his or her face reflected in every public institution, from school board and city council to provincial legislature and federal parliament. Think of all the people who are a part of our communities. Think of the many religious beliefs that are followed and the faces of the people who follow them. Think of the rich cultural practices, the different languages. Think of those faces. Think of those who can climb stairs and those who can't. Think of those who live in urban centers and those who live in rural areas. Those who live in isolation, those who are young in years, and those who are bent with hard work and time. Think of people whose lives consist of a series of problems who are on a permanent waiting list. Our challenge as Canadians is to take risks and bridge the fault lines that currently divide our society. We can't leave whole sectors of Canada's communities out in the cold. So we need to open this dialogue together. We need to collaborate, and not just when governance structures or political positions are at risk. Let's challenge our leaders everywhere, both public and private, to change our structures and style so that we become inherently more collaborative and inclusive. Let's listen to those voices that are not within our current frame of reference and act as their partners. It will enrich us all.
The institution of the ombud or ombudsman, first created in Sweden, by the way, more than 200 years ago, is designed, as we've learned today, to provide meaningful protection to an individual where there is a substantial imbalance of power between the individual and the government or corporate entity. And I hope I'm saying this correctly, that providing this support free of charge. Yes. And that makes the service accessible, as Fiona emphasized, to individuals who could not otherwise afford to pursue their complaints through the courts. That sounds to me like social justice in action on the ground. Our speaker has contributed significantly to the shaping of the ombudsman's role in our country and beyond. In a variety of settings, she has worked to ensure the fair and equitable resolution of disputes between individuals and governing bodies. But, again, Fiona emphasized this with clarity. More than that, she has shown us how the Ombuds Office can be an agent of change, helping organizations look at the root causes of the issues that caused the dispute and providing a basis to avoid such disputes in the future. Fiona, thank you for being with us this afternoon and showing us how the role of the Ombudsman has and will continue to serve as a reliable instrument, not only of resolving disputes, but in addressing inequality and giving voice to those in society who do not have a voice. On behalf of everyone in the room, thank you very much.